It seems intuitive upon first thought that the horror movie is a genre aimed primarily at an adult or late adolescent audience. But there have always been crossovers between horror cinema and films aimed at children and younger audiences. And these intersections are often complex. My guest today is Dr. Kat Lester from the University of Birmingham, and she has written a book called Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema, published by Bloomsbury, which explores an expanding body of films that could be termed as horror films for children. And she looks at the contradictions of such a thing, as well as some of the conventions of children's horror movies, including Gremlins, Coraline, Paranorman, and The Monster Squad. And I'm very pleased to be able to discuss her work here. Kat, lovely to speak to you. Can you tell us what first prompted your research into children's horror films?
Well, this is actually something that goes way back to when I was an undergraduate, to be honest. Although possibly even further back, when I think about all of the sort of inappropriate stuff that I would have watched when I was a kid. But really, the academic interest started as an undergraduate. I was doing my degree in English and film at the University of Hull. And at a certain point, I was doing a children's literature module on the English side and a horror module on the other side of the degree. And on the horror module, which was taught by Amy Davis, who I think is still there at Hull, there was a particular week on children's horror. And that was like a light bulb moment where I realized that these two things that I was already really interested in actually overlapped and intersected, and that a lot of the films that I had grown up watching and really loving could be described as children's horror films, things like The Witches and Gremlins, and all sorts of things, you know, Goosebumps on television. And it all just snowballed from there, I guess. I wrote an essay for that module, the horror module. I then did a master's dissertation on children's horror, a PhD thesis on children's horror, which now has turned into a book.
I suppose the first question would be, what films are we talking about here? And what's the distinctions between children's and adult horror?
Yeah. So when it comes to deciding on the corpus for the thesis and then subsequently the book, it was a bit challenging because there were certain films I absolutely knew I wanted to write about. Some of the ones I just mentioned, which I had grown up watching, films like Coraline, which came out when I was an undergrad, and Paranorman, which came out between my master's and my PhD. So those were films that seemed very obvious to me as films that were drawing from the horror genre and which were specifically addressed to children or at least family audiences. But because children's horror isn't necessarily a really widely recognized category, I think partly because the idea of children and horror, people don't always seem to think those go together. So when it came to trying to actually seek out further examples, it could be a bit challenging. A film like Coraline, for example, if you go to its IMDb page, horror isn't even one of the generic categories that's listed for Coraline. And that's the case for quite a lot of films, which I would call children's horror films, because it's absolutely a scary film. Lots of other people and children think it's a very scary film. So it generally just sort of came about by me plugging in as many keywords into like IMDb keyword search as possible, but also just through as much viewing as I could and reading as I could. But a lot of it came down to personal preference. There was also the question of how do I actually define horror, which sort of, I guess, relates to your second question in a certain way. Because they're for children, they obviously can't show or do some of the things that we might expect from what I call adult horror, or which most people might just think of as regular horror films. They can't be as gory, they can't have as many like intense jump scares and that kind of stuff. So they often have to be hybridized with other genres like comedy or fantasy, sci-fi, and that complicates things a bit as well in terms of the labels. And another issue is what we mean by children's film. So there's a definition of children, or at least three definitions of children's film that are proposed by a scholar, Ian Wojcik-Andrews. And he says, a children's film could be a film that was made to be for children, you know, intended to be for children, or it could be films about childhood, or it could be any film that a child watches, regardless of whether it was intended to be a children's film. And I think that all of those definitions are useful in different ways, but obviously not especially useful when you're trying to narrow down your corpus of texts, right? If we assume that any horror film could be a children's film just because some children have watched it at some point or other, and children do often watch horror films they're not supposed to watch, then that potentially means that any horror film can be a children's horror film, which is not a useful category. And then the other issue is, do you include unintentionally scary things, you know, things that like Nosy Bonk is something like a children's TV program from the 80s that I don't think was supposed to be scary, but a lot of people who grew up in the 80s find it to be horrifying. So that's why in an article that I first wrote, which was published in Velvet Light Trap, and then subsequently, which ended up being part of chapter one in the book, I tried to come up with what is a fairly rigid definition of children's horror, where I take genre theory like that by people like Noel Carroll and kind of apply it to children's horror, which ends up with a fairly narrow definition, which I think was helpful for me in trying to keep a manageable corpus of texts, but which some people might disagree with, and I'm quite happy for people to disagree with that and sort of tear it apart, and as long as it means they're engaging with it, really.
There seems to be a bit of a difference when I look through this, of the films that you look at, between films like Gremlins, which are original pieces of work, and films like Paranorman, Frankenweenie, the Monster Squad, and Hotel Transylvania, which seem to be riffing on adult horror, or what we normally would call horror history. And so is there a distinction between those two sets of films, between those that are reliant on the public's understanding of horror history, and something like Gremlins, which is kind of forging its own path?
That's an interesting distinction, which I don't think I'd ever really considered before. Definitely those films that are sort of pastiching classic horror iconography, what they're doing is they're using that horror iconography, the classic characters like Dracula and Frankenstein's monster, etc. That's how they are showing their kind of horror credentials. They say, we know about these monsters, we know that children know about these monsters for some reason or other through various kind of intertextuality, and children just seem to sort of know what Dracula is even when they've never seen a Dracula movie, right? And they know that there is something appealing about those monsters, they know that it that they are recognizable, so it's a way to be of the horror genre without actually having to be scary, I think, which is such an important balancing act for these kinds of films. So they're able to be horror not through the emotional effects of the genre, but through the intertextual iconography of the genre instead. Whereas I guess Gremlins is also very intertextual and sort of pastiche, but in a different kind of way, isn't it? It's doing that thing that a lot of the films in the 80s did, of looking back to sort of a nostalgic past. Although in Gremlins, it's obviously very cynical, unlike something like Back to the Future, which is a lot more nostalgic. But Gremlins is also, well, like I said, it's very cynical. It is a lot more kind of hard-edged. It is really trying to be a scary movie in a way that some of those other ones are not to the same extent. So I guess it's the way that they're drawing on horror. Some of them are using the emotional effects and some of them are using the iconography.
Yeah, I think something like the Monster Squad, I'm guessing that the monsters in that, because in that film, it's the classic Universal monsters that they fight against, Dracula and Frankenstein and the Mummy and things like that. Mm-hmm. Frankenstein's monster, I should say. And fell at the first hurdle with that. so that still had a cachet, I think, around the kind of mid 1980s, right? So you understand that as kind of horror. I wonder whether that would be the case now. Something like Paranorman, that riffs on films like
Return of the Living Dead and a kind of more modern sensibility. So I wonder to what degree that was aimed at, those elements are aimed at adults. Is that the case, would you say? Is there an element of that to this?
I definitely do, because all children's films, to a certain extent, need to address the adult audience by virtue of the fact that children are taken to the cinema by their parents, right? Or an adult, a guardian. So there is an extent to which I think the films are using those references to appeal to the adult viewer, but I also don't think it's that sort of binary or simplistic. I think it is also that the people making those films want to honour the things that inspired them and that they grew up with. And in the case of Paranorman, the writer and co-director, Chris Butler, says on, I think, the commentary for the DVD or whatever, that he wanted to honour the kind of video nasty aesthetic that he had grown up watching. And we think of video nasties as being notoriously like not for children. But of course, you know, like I said, children do watch things that they're not necessarily supposed to. And actually, a different scholar, Chloe Germain Buckley, in her book 21st Century Children's Gothic, has written about the way that Paranorman and Frankenweenie are using some of those intertextual references and pastiches to also kind of introduce children to those ideas and those themes, and that they are using the kind of classic monsters, or in the case of Paranorman, the language of the zombie film, in a way that is, that can still be frightening or can still be funny, even if you don't necessarily get the reference, right? In that way that parody films, the best parody films, often do, that you don't always have to know exactly what's being referenced in order to kind of be in on the joke.
So let's talk about a little bit about that, because you just alluded to it there, this idea, you write about it in your introduction, the idea that children's exposure to, I've written this down, and I don't know whether this is a quote or whether it's a summary of a particular argument, so forgive me for this, but children's exposure to horror can provoke nightmares, etc., and so-called what we might consider to be negative responses. But these are not always negative experiences, according to those who grew up loving horror, right? So people who are horror fans often have stories and anecdotes of being terrified and nightmares and traumatized by these things, but we don't consider them to be negative experiences.
One of the perceptions about horror and children is that children should be protected from it because it can result in negative emotional responses. But I think also to characterize those responses as just negative is a bit unfair. Because a big part of the reason we want to watch horror movies is because we know we're going to be scared, and that's the fun of it. So whether we actually even describe that as negative, I think is questionable. So I think we tend to forget that, yeah, that's the point of horror. It's precisely because it is balancing that kind of negotiation between fear and pleasure, which is the subtitle of the book, right? Because those are the two key emotions, and that they are not necessarily separate. They're integral to each other. This is also something that actually I come across a lot in relation to Watership Down, which I've been working on recently, and my next book project is about Watership Down. I will often come across responses to that film where people are saying, oh, that traumatized me, it gave me nightmares, et cetera, but then they'll say, and it's my favorite film, right? And there was a tweet that I saw yesterday, actually, which I liked so much I bookmarked, so I'll just read it out as an example. He said, this movie is literally hard-baked into my naive, innocent, unknowing five-year-old mind. It fucked me up so deeply that young and brought intense emotions you aren't even supposed to feel at that age. Harrowing animation, 10 out of 10. Right? That's exactly it. But that's not the case for all children. And I think that's really important to remember as well, that some children are going to watch a film and be scared by it, and it might give them nightmares, and it might feel like a bad experience, but in the long term, they might actually realize that that is something that, that they enjoyed. And then for some children, they might be really scared and they decide, you know what, that's not for me. And I think adults are like that too. Some adults enjoy horror and some adults don't. And I think it's really important to remember that children are just as complex in their responses to things. And it depends on all kinds of individual factors, including where they watch something, what they've watched, the context in which they've watched it, and their individual age and kind of other factors like their emotional maturity and that kind of thing.
Can you tell me something about this idea, again, that you write a little bit about in your book, about the idea of children's horror cinema, or children and horror, as occupying this liminal space?
A big part of that is precisely the difficulty or the perception that children and horror are incompatible, which means that it's not always kind of recognized as a category. And something that I talk about in the book, as well as the journal article I mentioned before, is that there's always the risk with children's horror that it's kind of impossible, in the sense that if a children's horror film is too scary, it risks being considered not for children. And if it's not scary or not sort of horrific enough, it risks being seen as not horror, right? So there's always that balancing act that they have to try to manage. And they'll do that in different ways, like I mentioned before, with the sort of Hotel Transylvania versus Gremlins approaches. So that's the main sort of idea I think I'm getting at when it comes to that liminality, that it is really sort of in between these two things that don't feel like they should go together.
Yeah, and you also talk about this idea of you mentioned it before, this idea of it falling between this kind of harmful and beneficial space. And also this idea of, obviously, it takes place in the space between the adult and the child, both in terms of the audience and also often on screen as well, with the use of child characters to be the main characters in these films. And you also talked about this idea, briefly anyway, or allude to it, about this idea of something being didactic or subversive, right? And the children's horror being a kind of subversive genre, or having elements of subversion in it.
The subversion, I think all children's horror films are subversive to a certain extent by virtue of being horror films for children. Although obviously some are going to be more subversive than others. I think, to go again back to the sort of the Gremlins approach versus the Hotel Transylvania approach, Hotel Transylvania is, a mainstream Adam Sandler film. It's very much trying to be a sort of family comedy with some monsters in. I think that it has a lot of value for its own reasons. But when we compare that up against something like Gremlins or maybe the Monster Squad, we can see a distinct difference between what those things are doing. In something like the Monster Squad, you see children behaving in ways that we certainly today, we don't necessarily expect children to, be roaming around on their own at nighttime. Certainly not like wielding weapons like a shotgun or a crossbow in order to kill Dracula or the Wolfman. And then Gremlins, obviously, all sorts of crazy stuff happens in that film, which is why I love it so much. But there's also the way that these films represent child characters as the protagonists, first and foremost, like you just mentioned. And that's one of the key ways I think it differs from adult horror, is the representation of children as characters with agency and desires and the ones who drive the narrative. While adult characters, and especially figures of authority, are really represented as they're either the baddies or they are just kind of useless and not of very much help to the child characters at all. So I think there is a subversion there as well in that kind of anti-authoritarianism of the children's horror film.
What would you say the difference is between the films that you're looking at and other films, particularly made in the 80s, such as the Indiana Jones movies or the Goonies or something like that, which might have elements of quite strong horror and seems to be some quite strong crossovers with the films that you're referring to? How did you make the distinction between the different sets?
Something like the Goonies is interesting, I think, because, so we've just talked about the Monster Squad a bit. The Monster Squad in many ways feels quite derivative of the Goonies, I think. It came a couple of years later. It does feel a bit like, what if the Goonies, except they were fighting against monsters as opposed to just like grown-ups who were quite bad. But that is really the main difference for me in terms of what makes it a horror film. The Goonies is an adventure film, but it's not really drawing on anything kind of supernatural or any of the sort of key markers of the horror genre. There might be moments where it feels suspenseful, or there might be the occasional moment of where fear is supposed to be produced, but that doesn't necessarily make it a horror film for me. I think that you could argue that it is a children's horror film, but again, for the purpose of coming up with like a more narrow corpus for the book, it was just very easy for me to be like, nope, Goonies is not a horror film, so it doesn't count. But I certainly think that it's doing many of the same things in terms of the way it's representing children, in terms of, and by virtue of that, the way it's representing adults, and that really important degree of agency that is given to those kids. Something like Indiana Jones, I think that's also really important in terms of the sort of industrial and generic landscape of that era as well. These are all films that are operating in a space where the idea of the big adventure, especially this sort of nostalgic, childlike sense of sort of wonder and fantasy, is really important in the 1980s. And I guess it's just that Indiana Jones is an adult, he's a grown-up. And again, like the Goonies, it might have elements of horror. It's not necessarily, for me, a horror film. But of course, the Temple of Doom is such an important text in terms of the history of not just film, but also horror specifically, because with Gremlins, it was one of the films that prompted the creation of PG-13, which then becomes quite an important shift in the production of children's films and horror films, and by virtue of that, the children's horror film.
Yeah, I think that's what maybe I'm getting at. It kind of, maybe the acceptance of that sort of kind of extremity that you get in things like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark and in Temple of Doom allows for the possibility of that sort of content to enter what we consider to be a children's film.
Exactly. There's another really good book on children's horror by Philippa Antunes, and she has a chapter where she talks about Temple of Doom, Gremlins, and I think also Poltergeist. And she talks about, so Poltergeist comes first, then it's Temple of Doom, then Gremlins. And she kind of talks about it like a ramp, where Poltergeist was one of the earliest sort of PG films, where there was loads of anxiety about, should this really be a PG? Is it really suitable for families and children? And then Temple of Doom intensified that. And then finally Gremlins was like the straw that broke the camel's back.
And it's, I suppose, that Spielberg influence as well, if we're thinking industrially as well, that Jaws is a PG and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And these films have violence and content that in some other director's hands would have been granted an 18 certificate or an R certificate. There's something about Spielberg's influence that on the industry that kept the rating always very low. I've never quite worked that out really.
There was actually, I found out quite recently that the BBFC did used to have like this informal like label that they used to use for Spielberg films. The idea that Spielberg's name was enough to almost like soften those horrific elements, and so that they could justify giving it a slightly lower rating than might have been the case with if it was a different filmmaker. They don't have that anymore. I think it was very much like a not official thing. But I read a dissertation recently by someone called Olivia Ralton, who found this in a 1987 report for the Jaws video. So this is directly quoting, this film is directed by Steven Spielberg. We have a Spielberg overall category allowance, in brackets, SOCA, at the BBFC. SOCA has been applied recently to 1941 and Raiders of the Lost Ark, both passed PG, although all the examiners made their individual protests. Jaws fits SOCA perfectly. Which, that's just fascinating, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's how powerful Spielberg was and the idea of the Spielberg brand.
Yeah, I wonder what, do you know, and if you don't worry about it, I'll chop it out, but do you know what the certificate was for the Twilight Zone in America? Was that the Twilight Zone movie? Was that PG-13, PG in America? I think over here it would have been 15.
I think that came out before the PG-13 existed, so it would have been either a PG or an R. I'm just going to see if I can find it. IMDb says it's a PG.
Right.
Yeah.
So there was that.
Why do you ask about that one specifically? Because that is a Spielberg, isn't it?
He produced it, I think. I think Spielberg was a producer on that. But yeah, I don't think that affected the BBFC.
It looks like that was rated a 15 in the UK and then was re-rated a 12 in 2009.
Ah, okay, yeah. Did he direct something on that as well, Spielberg? I wish I'd brought it up now because I'm sounding ignorant.
That's all right. I think he did direct one segment. I have a feeling he did. Or if not, then he at least sort of was a producer. And Joe Dante, of course, who then the next year directed Gremlins, did one of the segments on that. And I think it was probably precisely what he did on The Twilight Zone that got him the Gremlins gig.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think Poltergeist over here was a 15 as well. Certainly was a 15 when it first came out.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, I don't think it was PG over here. Not to my knowledge. I'm pretty certain that was always a 15 in the video shop when I remember. Anyway, enough about Spielberg. And I don't want to keep throwing. I don't want to keep throwing other films at you and saying, "What about this? Why don't you talk about that?" I'm not.
That's all right. I don't mind.
There's nothing more irritating when you've written a book and when people say, "Yeah, did you write about this?" And you say, "No, I didn't. So I've only thrown this up just because it came to mind from reading your work. Was the Conjuring series? In that they're quite obviously there's a kind of intensity to the scare scenes, I suppose. But I can't recall whether anyone actually dies in them. Everything always ends up sort of all right at the end. There's a sort of family or pseudo family setup in it. And it's often through the lives of children. I think the first one's based on the Amityville scenario. And I think the second one's based on the Enfield haunting idea in London.
I mean, The Conjuring is interesting, I think, because I remember when the first one came out, there was a little bit of a hullabaloo made about the fact that it was rated R, and it got the R rating not for any kind of like violence or swearing or sexuality, but simply because it was just scary. And so there was that idea that something could be R rated just for being like too intense or suspenseful was quite interesting.
And I suppose that's where we're talking about this idea of children's horror falling into these liminal spaces, in these in-between spaces. You've got these, it's not a clear category, obviously, particularly not if we do go down the route of extending it to films that children might have watched when they were younger, that they perhaps either shouldn't have or were aimed at a different audience. Or you've got these, I suppose, entry-level horror films anyway, right? And I suppose The Conjuring would be one of them, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, actually, something I've been thinking about more since the book was published was the idea that there are lots of horror films with R or 15 ratings, which I think we could make an argument that they are children's horror films by virtue of the fact that they are told through the perspective of a child protagonist. So I think something like The People Under the Stairs, the Wes Craven film, could fall into that category. And I've written a chapter which is forthcoming in a Wes Craven edited collection, doing exactly that, arguing that it could be a children's horror film. Something like The Shining, even, because of the character Danny, and then the sequel Dr. Sleep as well, with the character Abra, who I think is a great character. I don't necessarily think that a horror film has to be told through a child's perspective to be a children's horror film, because obviously you have things like The Nightmare Before Christmas, right, which arguably falls in the category, but Jack Skellington's not himself a child. But I do think that there is something really interesting about these films, which were kind of made ostensibly for adult audiences, which is reflected by the ratings that they got, but which I can see them having a really strong appeal for children. I don't know if that might go anywhere in some future research, but I definitely think that the category of children's horror and the way I define it in the book is actually a lot more slippery than I lay down there. And I think it could be played with in lots of interesting different ways.
How do you deal with this idea of the kind of teen film and the way that because the ages of these children can obviously differ. And some films based around kind of teenagers are clearly aimed at adults, some perhaps less so. So what about this kind of teenage category? Does that muddy the waters at all?
Yeah, definitely. That was definitely a challenge for me when writing the book, and what do I do with teen films? And because I think you could make an argument that teen horror films are just as liminal, or maybe even more liminal, a category than children's horror, precisely because teenagers themselves are situated between child and adult. And they face many of the same challenges that children do, especially in terms of kind of limitations put on them socially by adults in terms of what they can and can't do. They might be even more likely to want to push back against authority. The solution I came to really is possibly a bit of a ham-fisted one, but when it came to teen films, especially when we think about the category of the slasher, which often is for and about teens, I basically just lumped them in with what I call adult horror films, because they tend to contain the types of kind of gore and violence that we expect of adult horror films. So it was easier for me to put them all together, precisely so that I could sort of define children's horror in opposition to that, really. And I do think that there are some films that do complicate that a little bit. I talk about a film called The Hole, which is the only film I talk about in the book, I think, where the main character is a teenager. It's never made clear what his age is, but I think it's probably like 16 or 17 or something. But in terms of its mode of address and the representation of horror and the sort of themes that it's dealing with, that is a film that very much feels like it's being addressed to a slightly younger audience. And it's very much about, even though the character is a teenager, it's very much dealing with the fears that he has, which stem from his childhood. So that's an interesting film that complicates things a bit. But if anything, those films are all the more interesting precisely because they are muddying those waters.
Maybe it's a slightly artificial distinction as well, because up until relatively recently, young adults and teenagers would have assumed to be the market audience the target audience for horror anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So all horror is aimed at young adults and teenagers, right?
Exactly.
That would have been the assumption of it.
Yeah, there's not the same kind of cultural resistance or anxiety about the idea of teenagers watching horror. It's really assumed to be, if anything, an extremely normal part of being a teenager and kind of like a rite of passage, like to go and see your first 15 rated film at the cinema, or, you know, to sneak in to your first 15 rated film at the cinema when you're not actually 15 and that kind of thing.
Can we just talk about the aesthetic of these films? certainly when I think something like we'd look at the animated films, maybe it's more complex when it comes to the live action films, but the animated films, there seems to be two ways that this is happening, particularly in the around Coraline and Paranorman. Whereas I look at something like Paranorman and the animation, the stop motion and the use of CGI as well, that dilutes the content, it dilutes the gore, it dilutes there's a bit where a kind of girl steps on the brain with her kind of high heels and then there's the tongue falling out of the zombie's mouth, and the gore or potential gore is softened by the animation. Whereas something like Coraline, it's the aesthetic, it's that stop motion aesthetic that leads to the sense of the uncanny and the horror and the terror around it. Can you say something about that? Am I correct in that assumption? Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I think it is really interesting to compare those two films, because even though they're both stop motion, they're by the same studio, which is Laika. They are using the medium in such different ways. Coraline, I think, is very much, it's a film that's rife with uncanny motifs in the way that it's about, you know, eyes being cut out and removed. It's about doppelgangers, like all of these sort of Freudian motifs are in the film. So the fact that it is also stop motion animated, I think, really enhances that sort of uncanniness that makes the film so unsettling, precisely because stop motion is often theorized as being uncanny, because it's all about taking these things that can't actually move by themselves and making it look like they're alive. Whereas Paranorman is much more of a kind of comedy horror, I think. Coraline does have moments of humor in it, but it's not really a comedy film. Whereas Paranorman is not doing that same, it's not leaning into the uncanny, it's very much leaning more into horror, and it's crossover with sort of splatter and disgust and kind of gross out humor and horror in the kind of way that William Paul talks about as being the essential sort of overlap between horror and comedy. So in that context, the stop motion and the way that the stop motion is stylized in that film is really leaning into those comedic and gross out aspects, as opposed to the creepy, uncanny aspects that Coraline is doing.
Yeah, and I think I've written a little bit about Paranorman in an old chapter, and this idea of the way that they construct the bodies as well of the adult characters and the teenage characters to be almost not quite grotesque but exaggerated, right? You've got like the dad's really fat, and there's the elder sister's got really kind of exaggerated hips, and her boyfriend or not her boyfriend has got he's got a massive chest and broad shoulders. I suppose that's like, I don't know, kind of an abstraction of a child's abstracted view of what adults and older people look like, maybe.
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. Because I think the argument that I make in the book is that all of the characters, including the children, are sort of exaggerated to a certain extent. But I think you're probably right that the adults are subject to that a little bit more than the child characters like Norman and Neil.
Well, you'd know best. I mean, it's probably been about 10 years since I saw it. So 10 years old and 10 years since I saw it. So,
yeah. But I think... the argument that I try to make in the book is that the sort of roughness of the character design in that film is all about part. It's all part of the film's attempt to destabilize the idea of what normal is. I mean, that's why it's called Paranorman, right? And the idea that everybody is a little bit sort of abnormal in their own kinds of way, and that's the whole point of the film. You have another character who comes out as gay at the end, and you have Neil who lists off all of his kind of illnesses and things with cheerfulness. He's a delightful character. I love Neil. Yeah, so it's a film that's very much about, it's very sweet because it is very much about saying everyone is normal in the, or abnormal in their own kind of way. And we, in the case of Norman, it's that he can speak to the dead, but also that he likes horror films, which is one of the things that I really love about that film, is that it's about a kid who really likes horror. And it's a story as much about the other people in his life accepting that he likes horror and that that is fine.
And that, I suppose, that that level of acceptance and that message is what makes it a children's film, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
In contrast to what we might consider to be adult horror. So just to finish up then, can you just tell us a little bit about your project around Watership Down and how that relates to the work that you've done on this book on children's horror?
Mm. So Watership Down, it was the kind of film that was always sort of at the margins of my PhD thesis. I never really considered including it as a case study, partly because it's British and the thesis and book focused on American films, but also because of this sort of tension around the idea of whether it is a children's film and even whether it is a horror film. But I don't know if you remember this, but a few years ago in 2016, Channel 5 broadcast Watership Down on Easter Sunday. And there was a whole like Twitter storm of people saying like, what are you thinking showing this film to kids on Easter Sunday? They're going to be traumatized and blah, blah, blah. And I just found the whole thing to be quite amusing. But also I was like, what is it about this particular film that 40 years after it's been released, it's still kind of generating this much attention? And that's when I started to get really interested in thinking about it a bit more and thinking about why it has that reputation, especially when I think that that reputation overshadows all of the other wonderful things about that film. The fact that it's a really beautifully animated film, it's a really important kind of landmark in British animation. That led to a conference, a small conference, where the whole point was to both think about the sort of horrific reputation of that film in more nuance than is usually given to it. Because I think that the idea that it's just this traumatizing kids film, sort of, there's a lot of things we can actually unpack from that. There's a lot more to be said about that idea, especially because relating back to something we were talking about earlier, the idea that it was traumatic for a lot of people is not necessarily just a bad thing. A lot of people like the film precisely because they saw it when they were too young and it made a big impact on them. So the conference was about exploring that element in more detail, but also about exploring all the other wonderful aspects of the film, its aesthetics, its use of sound, its allegorical potential, its production history, etc. And that was in 2018. And that has then led to an edited collection, which is due out with Bloomsbury this February.
And you're the editor of that edited collection, I take it.
That's right. Yeah, I'm the editor. And I also have written a chapter in the book about why we find the idea of scary rabbits to be so, I don't know, so strange or so, like, because I have rabbits. So I'm like, I know that they're really cute, but they can also be quite like little bastards when they want to be, you know? So that chapter was all about why do we find the idea of scary rabbits to be so strange? And I do a reading of Watership Down as a children's horror film.
Kat, thanks very much. I've really appreciated you coming and giving me your time for that. And it's a really great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So thanks again to Dr. Kat Lester for speaking with me today. Her book, Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema, is out now, published by Bloomsbury. And also thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.